Okay, good evening, everybody. It's Wednesday night. It's 7 o'clock, and it's HBM Revisited. Tonight, we're going to continue with where we were last week. We did Chapter 9, but there's so much meat, and it's such a, what I call a critical, fundamental chapter in the book that I think we need to take another hour on it. So we're back on Chapter 9. We took a look at it. We got our feet wet last week, I think, M.A.,
yeah.
Would you agree?
A little foot wetting.
Yeah, it's just moist, a little moist. But to begin this class, I'd like everybody to, this is one of the exercises I use to help clean off what I call the road dust of the world and try to enter the space that we all are in so we can work together in a very fresh manner. So just relax for a moment, and if you can, place your attention on the words that I'm going to be reading at the moment. So just take a moment and just center yourself for whatever that might mean for you. And now, let's begin. In motion, bowing, my presence comes to thee. Humbly, with heart alive, my presence awakens to thee. With clear mind, my presence comes to know thee. With pity for thy suffering, my presence becomes aware of thee. With yearning, my presence wishes to comfort thee. In ignorance, my presence serves thee. In contemplation, my presence recognizes how to serve thee. In mystery, my presence is a comfort to thee. In form and formlessness, my presence becomes thee. Thank you. So let's reorient ourselves. Let's remember where we're at. And Simon, would you do me a favor, if you would please, and reread the header to Chapter 9?
All right. Title, Study of the Machine. Although we are separate from the machine, we have become hypnotized, immersed in the sleeping state of the machine. One of the purposes of studying the machine is to gather evidence which can help us define the exact nature of this sleep.
We're going to, one of the things I want to study this week, and it's going to be very useful to get feedback from all of us here. And I'm very glad that MA was able to join us, because she's going to have some unique slants. We've got a couple of emails. I got a couple of emails that were very useful in helping us get through some of this material. I'm going to jump. I'm not going to be reading as carefully as I have in the past weeks. I'm going to jump from several points that I'd like to make. And we're going to use that structure, in a sense, to help us get in a sense of what this is. And I'm going to be focusing on what does it mean to gather evidence. Okay, so I'm going to, right on the first page of this chapter, which is 63 in this particular version of The Human Biological Machine as a Transformational Apparatus by E.J. Gold. And the second paragraph indicates, although as essential beings we have separate existence apart from the machine, we have become distracted from our native state. I wanted to bring focus on that word, our native state. What is that native state? I'm going to throw a concept out that's a little challenging to us. You know what that is. You know what that native state is. But we fear to take, in my opinion, take the responsibility of pointing to that and say, I know what that native state is. Because once you start to own that, to use the current vernacular, you own that and you take responsibility for that position, in a sense, you're stuck. You're stuck with it. And we have then responsibility for our lives. So let's just discuss briefly, what do you think is meant by this phrase here that the author gives us? Distracted from our native state. What could he mean by that?
The state of grace of that essential self, the origin.
Can you taste that state of grace?
Slightly.
Okay.
When I become very, very aware of myself, sometimes it's a bit stronger. Sometimes it's a bit lighter, but I have had moments of that, at least that place of objectivity or grace or calmness or not judgment.
So when what I'm posing is I'm saying we know what that is. A lot of the times we wait for it accidentally to occur.
I'd like to jump in here and posit a definition that the native state is other than the sleeping state. And the native state is exactly what we're trying to get evidence about, as well as the sleeping machine. But turning our attention on the sleeping machine helps us to realize our native state.
We are, in the beginning of the paragraph, it says, as essential beings, and when we're able to live, in a sense, from our essential being, we are truly in our native state. It's the most normal thing that there is. It's so normal that it's too simple for the human mind.
Yeah.
It's just too simple for the human mind.
I have a few comments here if you want me to read them.
Please.
Zazen, state of clarity.
Okay.
Silverdale, I think of our native state as light in infinite extension, characterized by a vibratory nature. Sama, distracted into thinking we are the machine or the ego, we forget we are essential one.
Very good.
Silverdale, it is the deterioration of this light that produces the gross material world of our machine. Ginger Rogers, simple presence and attention is our native state.
Simple presence and attention is our native state.
And Agni Vyaraja, conscious state, aware, alive.
Nice. So we are manifest from the infinite light of being that there is. And in a sense, the absolute became manifest. It became manifest, and here we are. And we are in a human biological machine, but it's the divine spark that for some reason, which we're not going to define at the moment, we don't need to do our work here, this level of work that we're doing at the moment. We've become manifest, the divine spark, our native state. We've become manifest in this thing here. The physical centrum, the moving centrum, the mental centrum, and the emotional centrum that makes up the human biological machine. And at some point, we're going to realize how bloody fortunate we are. We have the chance to do that. So underline, though you can't, underline what Silverdale's comments are there. And note, I think it was what Sama said. Okay? We're gonna come back to those. That's the essential part. Jumping ahead, I'm just leaping ahead here. Page 64. We can learn how to see and sense the machine's sleep, and we can gather incontrovertible evidence of the machine's sleeping state beyond a shadow of a doubt. Evidence strong enough to stand up in a court of law. Study of the machine's sleeping state can also serve a second purpose, helping us to define the exact nature of this sleep. You, earlier, when we were talking over dinner, you actually made a comment about this particular area. Does this ring something for you that you maybe would like to say, M.A., or?
Mm. Oh, give me a hint.
So, becoming aware, so it says here, we can learn how to see and sense the machine sleep. And it's a pivotal piece of information that I want to get to here. How do we know something? How do we know when we're in sleeping state? Now, you know, many of us are either Lutheran or Catholic, actually, by a certain kind of Christian definition, if you think about it, and or growing up in this society. And so the concept of sin is there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we were talking about.
Right. We were talking, actually it was you that said this, which I thought was interesting, is that when we are in, as we recognize that we are in the sleeping state and we're reading this information, it jolts us into a place that we might think that it's actually almost a sin to be in the sleeping state. From a kind of a pseudo-religious side of it, you know, if you look back and how you felt about certain concepts and whether you were doing these concepts or learning about them or not learning about them. Not doing
this. See, the trick of the machine itself is that when we look back and we notice that the sleeping state has occurred, we feel guilty about it. And as soon as you start to feel guilty about seeing it, the machine itself, the mental centrum, has stolen that from you, has stolen that observation, because it's a simple observation of what the sleeping state may be. Now, I'm using the term observation and evidence here in a very specific way. We're noticing the sleeping state, okay? We're noticing. It's one form of knowing. You see it. You go, oh, there it is. That proves I was in the sleeping state. That's a form of knowledge.
It may take many, many observations, though, to even come to that. And that's okay.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
It really is,
yeah.
Okay.
This is, what I wanted to say is that this is not something that we're going to end with on Chapter 9 and never do again. This is something that we continue on. I've been doing it for, you know, since I heard the information in the first time, in the Crestline information. This is something we do all our lives. This is not something that is going to be just a one-shot thing. So this Chapter 9 is pivotal because it's something that if we do want to continue on in this work, this is something that we're going to be addressing over and over and over again in our life. The sleep of the machine.
It's a constant issue, and it's a constant issue that we will work with throughout our work as we're part of a human biological machine. There's nothing wrong with being in the sleeping state. It's just a fact.
And that's where we find ourselves. So what can we say about that? That's where we find ourselves. We have to work with what is and not what we wish would be. We are in a human biological machine, and we are hypnotized. And
that's where we find ourselves.
That's where we find ourselves.
And
so that's where we have to go.
So suddenly, and our opportunity here is there's suddenly a little distance between the two. So we can know that we're asleep. And this gets back to, you know, in the 17th century, I always refer to Spinoza, because I think he had all this stuff. He didn't have the context that I think was later developed by Gurdjieff and DJ. But, you know, he, for instance, he said the unique thing is you can have an idea of an idea. That, you know, that's part of the uniqueness of us. We can observe ourselves.
Sounds simple.
Sounds simple. Let's just keep working on it. Are there comments that need to be read, Simon?
No.
I'm going to bounce ahead to the end of page 65. In any case, we know or we have guessed that there is another state very different from the ordinary state. We call that our native state, which is possible for the machine, which leads to, note carefully here, which leads to another very different multidimensional experience of life than that to which we have become accustomed. So the author is saying, not only can you notice the sleeping state and sense your native state, but there's a whole other type of life that may be possible. And doesn't that make sense? Because if we've led our life from the sleeping machine, and as Silverdale has told us, we call that the historical personality, we've led our life from that. That's one form of life. And suddenly we can return somehow to our native state, and that's going to be this different, multidimensional experience of life. And I guarantee you, I tell you, that is possible, and it is fruitful. It is a fruitful way of life.
I was wondering if the people online had experiences that said that they were that they might have had an awakened moment in their life. You know, I'm curious if people have come to these ideas with the idea that there may be something else and some sort of experience that they might have had.
No, so far here, no. Agnirida just says, I had one that lasted most of a whole day. Lost Horizon, yes, definitely.
Definitely.
Agni Vidya, perception was more like feeling than looking and hearing.
Good, mm-hmm. Very good. Very, very important point.
Yeah, that's very important.
Okay, we're going to expand on that particular point in just a moment.
Zazem, yes, fleeting. And Silverdale, I continue to strive towards achieving this and crossing the threshold.
Yes. And he knows where he's going, too. And then I'm going to jump ahead now once again to 67. We speak of the sleeping and waking states in terms of perceptions and sensations because it is a machine state. Because it is a machine state and the machine has two definite and distinct experiences which are measurable by its senses and sensations, the difference between the two states of waking and sleeping are very clear. They're very clear.
The senses and sensations.
Go for it.
A little different than the intellectual center, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah. We can use the mental centrum to point things out to us, but we're talking about quality of knowledge here. What is the quality of knowledge? And this is what I really wanted to get to tonight, is that eventually we can observe, let's say, the fact we are in a sleeping state. And we say, oh my gosh, I was in a sleeping state, and you know what, I totally yelled at the person at the counter, I was distracted, and I just blew off at her. All right, yeah, that is, by deduction, you were in a sleeping state at that time. You deduced it. But what about direct sensing and perception of it? Can you know it directly?
Can I share something with you?
Yeah, please.
We know as we talk that strictly direct perception is very tough because the moment that we put the eyes on our machine, it changes. The behaviors change. So strictly direct by ourselves is very tough. But the closest for what I call direct experience is, for instance, that I say, being aware of myself, I say, okay, I'm going to meet with this person. I'm not going to talk about this. I'm not going to talk about this. And I arrive with that person, and within seconds, my sleeping machine starts talking about that.
Of course.
But in that moment, I got myself in fragante delictum.
Very good.
You know what I mean? Right away, I wake up and I say, what am I doing? So that is, do you think that is direct experience? I think it is.
I think it's a good thing of self-observation.
The interesting thing, Simon, at that point is to be surprised by the waking state, but don't be startled out of it in a sense, and watch it continue to operate. It is so interesting.
Okay.
And there are sleeping states that as you begin to observe them, you can't get out of them.
Yeah, and that will be direct, right? That will be direct experience, right?
Now, let's... Okay, now, Mike, are you on? Mike Williamson? Okay. I'm not sure if he's on the phone.
Yeah, I am a phone muted, but I'm on.
Okay, Mike, is it okay with you if I read some of your email?
Yeah, sure.
And you might want to consider, or I can... You might want to consider posting that on the site for others. Mike sent a wonderful exploration of grappling with this very problem here. And I'm going to read parts of it, though the whole thing is worth reading if we have a chance to get it posted. So maybe I'm suggesting that discernment involves somehow using the word to go beyond the word. By word, I mean what we know as the labeling that occurs from the memory of the HBM, i.e., the already known based on the HBM's limited and untransformed view that is based on the assumption that appearances of being a separate body is not just a partial appearance, but the complete and impartial view. I'm just wishing to clarify something to myself and check it out. Consider this from the Buddhists, I think. always there is the danger of setting up a goal through some concept and then seeking that and so subtly avoiding being in the present moment or avoiding facing what the present moment is offering, avoiding the transformation being offered at any one moment. Trungpa said something like, open and abide with a felt sense of groundlessness of the present situation without retreating to the safe territory of conceptualization. And Mike goes on, then there is the possibility of arising a non-conceptual awareness. Let me repeat that. Then there is the possibility of the arising of a non-conceptual awareness. There can be the beginning of the vibratory sensation that we wish to allow and recognizing as that which is, as it were, all-encompassing, and which can learn to tune and use the HBM as a transformational apparatus. And jumping ahead, my comment, verbalization, I take to mean here the labeling provided by the HBM that if identified with only, serves unnecessarily conditioned, which is in reality a free or unconditioned energy, a free or unconditioned energy. This is a very unique mic, and for me, it's like, in my work, for myself, I use the term sensing as is probably my most important navigational tool. I sense the sleeping machine, and it has a distinct flavor for me. As I sense the waking state, and therefore when I am in the essential self or the non-phenomenal self, it has a flavor to it. And I challenge all of us here to, there is a place that you stand in where you have certainty of your perception. Bring that sense of certainty to the perception of when the machine is asleep. And you'll begin to develop this discernment that Mike is telling us about. What is certainty for you, I say? And this free, and discover the flavor of this free or unconditioned energy. That's what we're looking for. What does it mean that the awakened sleeping machine is a transformational device? What does it actually mean for us here? And if we pay very careful attention, and we, as we begin to awaken the machine and we sense what that is, you'll be surprised at what you find. But Mike has given us a hint here.
One thing he touched on, which we'll find pretty shortly, is the tricks of the machine to keep us asleep. And he started to touch on that a little bit, and how many ways that the machine will throw up barriers to the awakening of the machine, and it will.
It will mimic
every turn.
And so you have a fun challenge of finding out those subtle ways that it works to really steal this effort, take it back down into itself.
And I think that his idea of the energy,
yes,
that's what you can use that energy to thwart those tricks.
Very nice. If we fall back into judging the sleeping state, or we fall into, oh, I know what that is already, you begin to be to go back into what that sleeping state is. If you can harness and remain in the sensing of the vibratory sensation of the non-phenomenal self, which is what we've learned from Silverdale, is that you can begin to develop this great sense of discernment.
I'd also like to kind of point out that the author doesn't really give us gradations of sleep.
No.
He doesn't say, well, a little bit of that we're in a little bit of sleep here, or maybe a little bit more sleep at a different time. He gives us only a black and white picture. Either you're asleep or you're awake. And so if we think, oh, I'm only a little asleep, we've run into another trick.
It's another trick. It is. And it's small steps also.
Very small.
There's small steps,
very
and
small.
But it's a worthy effort. It's a worthy effort that is, you keep forever.
Mm-hmm.
You keep forever. No effort that springs from, as Molly was telling us, no effort that springs from the simple attention and presence goes unnoticed, uncharted. It's one penny in the essence bank. And eventually you have enough money to buy a treat.
I'll tell you a little story that happened sometime in the early 70s. That I was standing with EJ and other people in a small group, and we saw a car go by. And unfortunately, this is a terrible picture, but it really demonstrates, he really gave us a demonstration. It was a car went by with a dog hanging out of the car door. In other words, the owners of the car did not realize that the dog was stuck in the car and going along. And EJ made the comment, while we were looking at that, he said, you see, the thing is that we're going whether we want to go or not. We are going. And it really kind of brought it home. It's like, yes, it doesn't matter whether it'd be nice to go standing upright and feeling very good, but no matter how it is, no matter what work that we do in our life, we are going.
I mean, we're here after all. We're here at this particular meeting together. And yes, we are going ahead. We're part of this movement forward. And that the essential self has an opportunity now to work in a different manner. We have found a path. We're going along no matter what.
We're going to go. And as humans, we are going to go. So we have a little advantage here of trying to do a little bit of dying before we die and working on ourselves in a way that is maybe sets up a little something for us. But whether we work on ourselves or not, we're still going to go.
That's right. So... And so then I'm going to bounce ahead to page 72, and in the end of the top paragraph there, full paragraph, and the paragraph starts with, the states between sleep and waking are not at all calm. Some of them are quite painful. We must learn to endure certain types of pain without inflicting it upon ourselves or being stupid about it. And then finally, we must learn to endure the severe sensations of the waking machine, knowing that it leads to the eventual cessation of pain. So, and then, so I wanted to emphasize that point a little bit. The sensation of the awakening of the machine there's sometimes pain associated with that. I was wondering if anybody has had that experience.
That paragraph is on page 48 for anybody who's using the old edition.
Okay. So page 48 of the old edition.
Mm-hmm.
So the sensation of when the machine begins to awaken, do you feel that pain? I do. I have. In fact, I had an experience earlier this evening that I'd like to share with the group. I actually, I was with clients much of the day, and I got back. I settled in, and I sat down. And I decided I wanted to read this chapter again. And I had Mike's email, which was so delightful, and one other email, which I'm going to read from in a minute. And I wanted to sit down and start to read it. So I got in, I have a chair, and I have a little library, and I sat down, and I began. Nothing, there was no phones, nothing. It was quiet, no one was there. I began to focus on reading the chapter, and I noticed a strong sense of anxiety in my machine, and I wanted to get up and go do these other tasks that I remembered I needed to do, quote unquote. And I could feel the difficulty. I just couldn't sit there. This sensation of was overwhelming me in a certain way. I stuck with it, somehow stayed in the chair, and gradually started to fall into a different state of attention and presence. And once I got there and I stayed with it, I felt this native state, this natural state where I'm to be. A few minutes later, it started to pull me back out again. And I reasserted myself in a sense. But that moment of, I call that the moment of transit. And the moment of transit is painful and frightening. To whom is it painful and frightening?
Who was pulling you away?
Yeah. So my essential self was not fearful. It wanted to get back in the tub.
Maybe you had some direct evidence there.
So I could sense that anxiety. And then as I somehow exerted my will on that process, I crossed that barrier.
So you were overriding the will of the machine.
The machine was desperate. I mean, and the chuckle, the funny thing about it was is that the things I needed to do were just utterly ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh, I better run and check my email. I didn't check this phone.
Oh, would that be, David? That's interesting what you say. Would that be the a symptom in that situation? Because that happened to me. I never thought that I had those symptoms, as we talked before. But that situation that you are describing to me, it has happened so many times.
So
I never associated that. I never associated with the rebellion of my machine against the attention.
Watch it carefully and sense. The transition from where the machine wants to be. And in fact, give in to the machine every once in a while. Give in to it. Oh yeah, I'm going to go do these stupid tasks. And notice that sensation. Or notice sticking with it.
Some stick-to-itiveness when you're saying that you stuck there, that really can help. Just to go a little farther than you think you possibly can.
A little farther than you think you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And there's in the chapter, we know there's these conversations about a runner getting second wind. And I, you know, we've all found that to be the case. Sometimes the hardest thing to do is to start the exercise. The hardest thing to do in physical exercise is to actually start it, because you're convinced you can't do it, you'll never be able to, you're not strong enough, you know, blah, 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 blah.
It's too cold, it's too hot, I'm not feeling good,
I don't feel
really
good,
my feet hurt.
But if you actually go do it, 45 minutes later when you're done, your body's never felt better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really surprising because sometimes, you know, the description of the situation seems to be so strange or supernatural, but that is a very common thing that I all the time I am in that situation. So for me, it's very clarifying.
it's funny how this mysterious
awakening, you know, that happened to me so often, and I have noticed it.
We were talking about that earlier, about the making the path super mysterious. So mysterious, you never get to it.
Oh, it's too mysterious.
Well, yeah.
But it makes when it's this simple, more responsibility is on our shoulders.
It's so simple that it's hard to do, because it is so simple, and we have so many tricks that we can come up with to, we don't need to do this, forget that.
Yeah, Maryam, yeah, got it. You know, let me read you a couple of things here, if you don't mind. Silverdale, I have never experienced pain, only the sensation of a sleeping limb that is awakening, the feeling of blood beginning to circulate in a lifeless limb. Agni Didaja, that happened to me, Eastern Workshop, a while back online. Horrible anxiety. I didn't know what it was. And Ginger Rogers, the machine gets itself very stressed just before it lets go and allows itself to over the line into awakening.
Emma, you had mentioned that there was a particular exercise that you guys did some years ago in
mm-hmm.
Red House.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Can you? Do you want to repeat that again?
I was telling David earlier that I was concerned that perhaps that I had left people with a different impression of that. And I wanted just to clarify a little bit about the Red House. And along with that came up with this exercise that I think Simon had asked last week if there were any exercises. So one of the things I wanted to say is that we were busy working on ourselves. We were very, very, very busy. We were in a school. That's the way that we considered ourselves, that we were in a school. We had a teacher. We listened to the teacher. And we did the exercises. So people, we knew that our fellow students were working very, very hard internally. They're doing all this internally. It's some of it's externally, but a lot of it is internal. So we know that our fellow students are working on these exercises, and that we're doing these things in they're very difficult, and that we're trying in every way possible. So the idea was to be sure that we were kind to each other, that there was a recognizable kindness. And Vijay gave us this exercise, which I think is a variation on a Buddhist exercise called the Buddha. And what we called it was the God game. And we used it with each other. We would, when we encountered somebody, we would look at them and we would think about them as being gods. And we would ask ourselves, what does this God have to say to me? What is it that's important that I need to hear from this person. So it became, it was a very good way of really working with another person in this group. And so I just wanted to let you know that it was very, it's a very different kind of way of working, but we did very.
Think of doing that exercise when you're sitting there and the person is really a jerk and they're coming off and you're reacting like crazy. Can you be in that state? Can you be in the state where you're in attention and presence? And you're going to see at that moment the struggle for the machine to assert itself. And it's saying it has the right to get angry at that other person.
Mm-hmm.
It has the right to. It's justified in it. And all these powers of the ego come up. The giant, almost infinite ego, powerfully asserting itself every chance it gets.
And this, David and Marianne, that this experience, this exactly that David just related, is what we were talking before in those sensations when the machine doesn't want to lose ground. That is the scenario, right?
Yes.
Yeah, when the machine doesn't want to lose ground, but, you know, if you really start working with these ideas, if you really trying to do these exercises, you are trying to get that machine to lose ground. You are not trying to resist. So it's different than if you're out in public and you just run across somebody at random and they're misbehaving, as compared to somebody who is in a group situation who's working with these ideas very strongly. You're not going to get those manifestations. We're really trying to work on ourselves. So we're really trying to be on our very best behavior and really trying to sense the sleep of the machine. So you are, when you get out in real, that's why it's very difficult, because we are surrounded now in our everyday life with outside people. I mean, here we are. We're not in this kind of intense situation anymore.
Well, except our efforts now are, we are in the world. We have to recognize we're not of it. So we're taking these opportunities. We're not in the boiler, the steam heat of a school working together, but we still have an opportunity. We are in life. We're not without tools, though. And that's those tools over all these years, as we discussed, have been distilled into this manual of how to work.
Exactly. EJ, really, when you want to know what happened at Questline, all you need to do is really pick up the HCM, because he really did distill the best of the best, and we didn't have the words. He was working it all out. So now we actually have a manual.
It was years later that this came into being,
mm-hmm.
and they were experimenting with how to formulate it
mm-hmm.
at that time.
And EJ was studying us, believe me, just as hard as we were studying
how do those
him
things
and
work.
How this works. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to jump ahead to page 73 of this volume. Ordinarily, our system is cathartic and extremely mild. Developing the will of the essential self gently and awakening the machine slowly so that it does not go too far out of balance. So it's a lot of small efforts, and we can do that right now. And right now. And when the class is over, and then we can do it right now.
This is what I was kind of getting to this last week about going to various individuals who who can take you into an experience where they basically I call it a stripping away. We're talking here about a lifelong way of working gently and permanently, rather than a stripping away that is momentary and impermanent.
You're gaining solid ground here.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but I want to, there's a couple of more things, another points I want to make. And jumping ahead, I'm on page 75. Direct observation of the machine has the effect of changing the thing that is being observed. It is a broad application of the Heisenberg principle. So we don't know, you know, you observe something and it starts to change it. But it's the continual efforts to bring something about. And I want to read from the second email I got. It was very, I'm not going to identify the individual at the moment, but my prayers to myself are being answered this month. I don't know how, but I'm shedding negative karma from so long ago with every passing day. And I know this person, how they, what they're working on, and for this person, it's a continual level of effort, but it's constant.
That is the key. I think that that really is the whole key about the whole concept of working on yourself. I think the key is in continuity. Can you continue to do it? Or is the machine can exert its will pretty darn fast and say, oh, yeah, a couple of weeks later, oh, yeah, I forgot I was doing that, wasn't I? A month later, oh, yeah, I should observe myself. But if you can get those moments together where we have more continuity, I think that is the key.
Go ahead, Simon.
No, that's fine. Thank you for sharing, Marianne. That's good. Thank you for the example you gave before to the God. That reminds me to an exercise in the 24, too. It was something close to that.
Yes. And so we do those exercises. You know, all these exercises that we've been given, they're all wonderful, if we can remember to do them.
If you awake the machine to do it, right?
They're awake enough to remember that we even read them.
And let's discuss the exercise at the end of this chapter, then. And the end of this chapter, it's the second to the last paragraph. It's 78 on this book. We must agree to make these observations for a full 30 days, but no more. This is a once-in-a-lifetime effort. If we are to gather the force for observation in sufficient potency, we must agree that no matter what happens after the 30-day observation, we'll never make this effort again. But just think of this as a strategy of work. You get a notebook, and you carry it with you all the time, and you make observations all day long. You write something down in the morning, in the afternoon, later on in the afternoon, at night, before you go to bed, when you wake up, and you make these observations. What are the observations? Well, if you read the paragraphs just before it, it says, all evidence must be clearly indicated as direct evidence, circumstantial evidence, or hearsay evidence. And we got a clue as to each of those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, direct evidence of the sleep, circumstantial, where I must have been asleep. Hearsay is when someone else says to you, you were asleep right then. If you did something like this, the momentum of the observation skills that you have becomes so strong, they don't get lost.
Ah, uh-huh. Make a new habit?
Ah.
That's the one I think of.
We make a new habit. So what do you think about doing such an exercise?
Yeah, sure. I was, remember, unfortunately, the last class that we had, you were asking David to Marianne in the hearsay exercise that she was doing in the group, and you were asking her how does the group get to be objective? Remember, David, how the other person can tell you something objectively, and it's not the other person machine telling you that.
Yes.
Remember, and I guess you didn't have the chance to answer that, but it was a great question to see what discernment has the other party to tell you, hey, what's wrong with you?
Well, you need an awake person.
Sorry, to finish the thing, it was a very, very important. There was a very important thing that you have a mediator.
Well, sometimes the sleep of your machine doesn't bother me at all, and I just note it. Remember Harry's conversation about his friend talking about him pulling his beard. This was a couple of weeks ago, where his friend hadn't seen him for, or not his beard, his mustache, and Harry had this habit of pulling on his mustache every time, and his friend says, "You're asleep when you're doing that, and it bothers me and everybody else that sees it, but you don't even notice it, do you?" Well, that friend was clear in that moment, mm-hmm. and so much so that Harry's remembered that moment after many years. So the chance of somebody being awake or objective may or may not occur, but you can, but you take the chance when you get it. And if someone says something to you, are you looking at a angel who has come upon, and they're giving you some feedback about your work as a machine? Or are you protecting your ego? That's a discernment you need to make. And a few weeks ago, Mark Roche was on, and he says, how do we know when it's time to help somebody? You know when it's time to help someone else when you're able to help someone else. When you're able to do it, then you give that other person some help at that time.
I think also that the other person must ask for help first, that they must be open. You don't just walk up to somebody who's, has nothing to do with any of this and just tell them what a jerk they are because they're asleep. We're all asleep. We have to remember this. This is the caveat part of this chapter. We are all asleep. So he's not asleep more than I'm
That's
asleep.
Right. Well put. When you enter into working in a school or you work in the environment we are here, there's an implicit understanding that we're all here and we to awaken ourselves and to work towards transformation. Since we're in that shared environment, we're vulnerable. And we open ourselves up to that impact. That's what we can get from working together.
And I truly believe that a third party, go back to the Gurdjieffian idea of fair witness, that's a pretty important concept.
Nice.
So I don't like the one-on-one too much. I always think a triad is the better way to go on this. You know, it can get very psychological, and that's not where we're going with this at all. You don't want to go into those kinds of realms. It's just telling somebody else that they're asleep. That's not it at all.
So some of our takeaways from this chapter then are, can we get a sense of the direct discernment of the sleeping state and the waking state, and the transit between the two as well, when we get a moment to observe that. So that's what we can bring. When, in addition to that level of discernment that this chapter is leading, I think is the prize from this chapter, we also have the exercise of doing self-observation and recording it in a notebook, actually writing it down. When you do that, it makes it very objective. And as I say, It puts the sleeping machine on notice that that observation is beginning. And then the habit begins to form until it's an everyday part of your work life.
I'd also like to say, just something I thought about, that if we do this little exercise, and if it's true that every time that we look at our sleeping machine that it wakes up a little bit, look how many times we'll be awake.
That's right. And that's what we learned from that second email, is that constant effort at it is what helped her shed some of these karmic loads that she had. And so let's see how we do. See if you get a direct sensation of what it means to be asleep and what it means to be awake. And we'll approach it again next week when we take on Chapter 10. So thanks for coming. I look forward to seeing you next Wednesday at 7. Good night. Thanks for everything.
Thank you very much. Good night, Marianne. Bye, David. Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mike, can you hang on a second?